But then as I was asking myself these questions about, like, literally what kind of regenerative agriculture is adequate to the challenge of climate change, that's what kind of led me to these deep cooperative histories within the African diaspora or within indigenous communities in North America or within indigenous communities in other parts of the Americas. And it became clear to me that if we don't sort of make the case for taking leadership from those communities, that regenerative agriculture will never sort of realize its potential to combat climate change.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Liz Carlisle about her latest book, Healing Grounds: Climate Justice and the Deep Roots of Regenerative Farming, which centers the stories of indigenous, Black, Latinx, and Asian American farmers who are reviving their ancestors' food growing methods, techniques long suppressed by the industrial food system. An assistant professor in the Environmental Studies program at UC Santa Barbara, Liz Carlisle teaches courses on food and farming. Born and raised in Montana, she got hooked on agriculture while working as an aide to organic farmer and U.S. Senator John Tester, which led to a decade of research and writing collaborations with farmers in her home state. Liz, welcome to The Right Question.
It's great to be here, Lauren.
I'm so happy to have you in Studio B here at MTPR. I want to start our conversation at the end of your book, actually. Will you read from the conclusion of Healing Grounds?
I had been preoccupied with a narrow question. How many tons of carbon can farmers suck out of the atmosphere and store underground? Pinning down this number proved elusive, as scientists pointed out the dizzying array of variables involved, from soil types to crop varieties to the length of time you assumed a particular form of management would be sustained. Truthfully, they admitted, we're just beginning to understand how to measure the movement of this tiny, consequential element. What we do know, however, is that carbon cycling works pretty well in healthy, functioning ecosystems. Wondering if I'd failed to look at the most fundamental question underlying my whole project, I eventually asked Stephanie Morningstar a very unformed question. I'm sure the words didn't come out in this order, but the essence of it was this. So, what is the climate crisis? I mean, really? This is ancestor work, Morningstar answered. Everything we're doing is ancestor work. Not just me, not just Black folks, not just people of color, everybody. Climate change signals a profound imbalance, Morningstar explained, rooted in the violent restructuring of relationships between people and land that lies at the very heart of this continent's history. This rupture disrupted the connections that make healthy, functioning ecosystems possible, including the connections that weave humans into the fabric of a place. That means the vital work of rebuilding soil carbon is inextricably woven together with the vital work of racial justice. What we are doing is we are healing our ancestral lineages, Morningstar clarified. It's about going back to the root issues, indigenous land dispossession and enslavement. How do we right those relationships between our own communities so that we can heal those things in this healing ground? So, healing the climate means healing land? I asked, trying to follow Morningstar's train of thought. And healing land means healing colonization? That's it, Morningstar said. That's the work.
That's a huge question, or that's a huge idea, healing colonization. And so now that you've begun at the end, I want to take us back, or take listeners back, to the beginning of this project. In your introduction, again, let's go back to the beginning, you write about a conversation you had with Francesca Cotrufo, a soil ecologist at Colorado State University. And was it your conversation with Francesca that kind of pivoted you into this world, into these questions? And if not that conversation, what began this project for you?
Yeah, that conversation with Francesca was a real catalyzing point. It kind of started me down the path, I think, of this project, because I've been interested for a really long time in the idea that even though farming as it's practiced now within the dominant food system in the United States, even though it's often the cause of a lot of environmental problems and particularly climate change, that there are these ways that our farming and food system can be shifted such that it becomes really an environmental solution and a climate solution and a way of stewarding land and restoring ecosystems. So for the last dozen years or so, I've been having conversations with farmers and scientists who are working on those things, and that's really been my focus as a writer and as a researcher. And in recent years, this idea of agriculture as a climate solution, and specifically the idea that there are practices through which farmers can sequester carbon in the soil, literally pull it out of the atmosphere and sequester it in the soil, that's gotten a lot more popular. So it's at the center of these major documentaries and the IPCC report, and people are seeing it on like a General Mills cereal box. There's been a lot more kind of popular conversation about what's being called regenerative agriculture. But what I've noticed is that people in the scientific community don't really agree about how much of a climate solution this really is. And so that conversation with Francesca first helped me understand the difference between regenerative agriculture as something that's really more of a marketing term, but not really having a big impact on the climate, and the kind of regenerative agriculture that really would make a major ecological difference. And what Francesca told me is that it's all about roots.
And I want to get into the nuances of roots and this different kind of regenerative farming that we're talking about. But just to maybe parse or even just ask a broad question, are you optimistic? I feel like you went from, I have an idea about what I'm going to write about, something very specific and something probably, you know, very much in your knowledge base. And then you end the book with this huge question and this huge something that doesn't really feel like an easy solution at all.
Yeah. It's a good question about sort of, am I optimistic? And I think there's a writer that I have always really admired in terms of how she deals with this and environmental topics, Frances Moore LePay, author of Diet for a Small Planet, and many, many, many more brilliant books. And she describes herself as a possibilist. And so she said, you know, I'm not a pessimist. I don't automatically think we're headed for this dark apocalyptic future when I think about the environment. And yet I'm not an optimist in the sense that I don't think that without my action and collective action, we will head down a more positive path. But I believe in highlighting what is possible. And so that's been really influential in terms of how I think about my writing and the way I approach this book, is that I wanted to showcase what is possible, what roads could be taken. And it's a kind of, I think, a challenge to all of us to realize that we're at this moment in history where we really do have choices collectively about the path that we take ecologically and socially. And so in a way, I think it's exactly the moment to be ambitious and to look at that ambitious vision of the kinds of communities we could live in if we took the actions that are maybe at the edge of our collective capacity. And so that's what I wanted to highlight in this book, is what really is possible if we reach for maybe kind of the best of us as human society.
I love that. You're maybe not a pessimist, and maybe optimism isn't the word, or optimist isn't a word, but you're ambitious.
Yeah, and I think we should be ambitious. I think sometimes there's this kind of desire to maybe be pragmatic or to think about like, well, what's possible even if, you know, most of humanity doesn't care about environmental issues, or what might we get people to do out of self-interest? I'm not very interested in those kinds of questions. I'm much more interested in what's possible if we reach for our true human potential and if we access our collective capacity.
You just spoke about roots, and I want to kind of dig into that word and that idea, and I'm hoping you'll kind of understand where I'm going here with my next question. What is your obsession with what happens in the margins? Or maybe another word for that, what is your obsession with the underground?
That's a good question, because we've probably talked before about my first book, Lentil Underground, and this book is called Healing Grounds. And so I have thought a lot about, like, I must be very focused on the ground and the sort of subsurface. And I think that's, for me, both ecological and social, is what are those root processes that drive a lot of what we all experience in our lives, and how can we get to the root causes of issues like climate change and racial injustice, which are kind of the twin focuses of this book. And so I'm really interested in understanding problems and challenges through a deeper historical lens. And that was the big learning journey for me of this book, as a person who's kind of thought about the food system from World War II forward. This book really forced me to think about more like a 400 or 500 year history that led us to the food system that we have and the climate challenges that we have in the food system, and to actually kind of historically trace back to those roots of an extractive food system that started with genocide of indigenous people, that started with enslavement of African people, that being the root of having an extractive food system, of having an agriculture built on the plantation model, and thinking about how would we approach a regenerative agriculture movement if we saw the root cause of climate change issues in the food system dating back to those processes of colonization, rather than just as dating back to industrial agriculture and the use of more chemicals. What if we understood industrial agriculture as already being built upon an extractive model that's older and really is all about these issues connected to colonization?
I feel like environmentalism, or even agriculture, it has this wonderful intersection of metaphor and physicality, because we're talking about, in theory, these things work. We're talking about trying to reach beyond them or move beyond them, but we're also talking about, like, literal systems of the natural world. We're talking about tree systems, forest systems, fungal systems. And so you write in the book about reciprocity and cooperation. And I'm wondering what makes this book different from other books that speak to that? Because these ideas of collective action and cooperation, change as in a society, a system, reciprocity, environmental ethic, all of these things, these are not actually new ideas, right? What makes your book different from your forebears, the Edward Abbeys, the Michael Pollans, the Bill McKibbins of the world, apart from you are a woman? there are other examples I probably could have named there too.
Yeah, well, you've named a lot of people that I really admire. I remember actually reading Bill McKibben's book, Deep Economy, on a plane when I was coming home to Montana at a momentous time in my life when I was making really big changes in my career and my life and where I would live. And I just remember thinking, I want to create something this impactful. And then I had the chance to work with Michael Pollan when I was studying at Berkeley. So I think you've actually named people that are deep influences to me, and I hope that some of what I've created converges with what they've sort of had to share conceptually, the things they've made me think deeply about. I think I feel a responsibility as someone in the agrarian tradition of literature, and, you know, given the work that I've pursued already in a 12-year career, to think about these themes of cooperation situated in different histories than those that have been most dominant in the environmental literature. And, you know, specifically to think about non-white histories of cooperation, which haven't been highlighted nearly as much as things like, sort of barn raisings in the homesteading area, and it's a tricky thing because I myself am a white woman, so it's not necessarily my place. I think for many years it's made much more sense for me to think about how to, you know, read authors of color who are writing about these themes, and support students who want to write about these themes that are located in the long histories and traditions of their own community. But then as I was asking myself these questions about, like, literally what kind of regenerative agriculture is adequate to the challenge of climate change, that's what kind of led me to these deep cooperative histories within the African diaspora or within indigenous communities in North America or within indigenous communities in other parts of the Americas. And it became clear to me that if we don't sort of make the case for taking leadership from those communities, that regenerative agriculture will never sort of realize its potential to combat climate change. And so I think recognizing these really deep histories of reciprocity with land that are located in global indigenous traditions, it feels like really, really urgent work to me at this time in history. And to understand it, not only within, I think, this story of homesteading and mutual aid that's often a kind of located within manifest destiny, but to understand cooperative economics as part of a counter-colonial project of survival and resistance. That gives it an entirely different lens, and I think one that addresses this challenge of climate change and climate justice in a whole other way. If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with me. I'm Liz Carlisle. This is The Right Question. My full conversation with Lauren can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and follow along on Facebook.
You mentioned the word urgent and the climate crisis. There is urgency here. We're past the point, as they say, and the publishing industry, however, is very slow. How do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile the work that you do as a writer and activist with the urgency of this changing planet? That seems in tension with one another, those ideas.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to be an environmental writer, or particularly an environmental writer who focuses on climate change or biodiversity loss or something where you feel like you have this short clock to resolve an issue, if the only thing that you think you're doing that has value is the end product. So if you feel like this work is only going to matter 2 years or 3 years down the road when this book comes out, I think it is hard to reconcile that sense of I need to take action now with the sense of this project is going to have a really long gestation period. But I think something that I find really meaningful in the work of writing is the process and the conversations along the way, both before the book is written, when I'm talking to people whose, you know, wisdom is informing this book and who will be quoted or whose wisdom is just suffused throughout the writing. And then also, you know, after the book, as people come up to me and share experiences that sort of something they read that resonated with an experience they had. So I now kind of see writing as this ongoing process of conversation. And so it doesn't feel like I have to wait until the book comes out to be engaged in the world and to be engaged in the work.
Liz, what is a carbon cowboy?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I think I first heard this term in maybe like 2017, referring to, this was kind of the beginnings of the term regenerative agriculture and the idea that there were, people in farming communities across the U.S. who were embracing the idea of trying to combat climate change through farming practices that would sequester carbon in the soil. And so specifically in the ranching community, carbon cowboys were folks who were excited about the idea of regenerative grazing and moving their animals across the land in patterns that mimicked the migration patterns of native herbivores.
You know, you use this term, like I said, in one of the earlier chapters, and it's titled Return of the Buffalo. And you mentioned these native herbivores. And this chapter is talking about regenerative grazing on the land by bison or buffalo. For listeners, can you synthesize that chapter, who the character, quote unquote, that you introduce in that chapter and what she's doing?
Yeah. So the lead voice of this first chapter is Latrice Tatsy, and she's an ecologist. She's actually just finishing up her graduate degree at Montana State, and she studies bison grazing and its impacts on the soil in particular. She's very interested in the potential of soil carbon sequestration and soil health through restoration of bison or buffalo. And she herself is a member of Blackfeet Nation. And not only she, but also her father, they've been really, really involved in restoration of buffalo at Blackfeet Nation, and even thinking bigger to restoration of buffalo throughout historical Blackfeet territory, which exceeds the boundaries of the current reservation. And they're also a cattle ranching family. So it's really interesting because that brings up, you know, sort of land management questions and land use questions. And oftentimes, cattle ranchers and buffalo restoration advocates have kind of been on opposite sides of the issue or in conflict about land use. But she really sees a complementarity. And so when she talks about regenerative grazing, she talks about how actually bringing buffalo, or ini in Blackfeet language, back to the landscape and back into that relationship with land that they've had and that they've had with the people, that bison can resume this role they've always had as a teacher. And so whereas in non-Indigenous conversations about regenerative grazing, I've heard the reference to the idea that native herbivores could be a conceptual model, that the way native herbivores used to move across the landscape would be a conceptual model that could be used to guide how you would set up your rotational grazing system for optimal forage and carbon sequestration. Latrice really explains how it's not just a conceptual model, that the native herbivore, ini, is a relative and has been in relationship with Blackfeet people, and that that native herbivore actually has to be returned to the landscape in order to heal all those relationships and for those buffalo to be there as a teacher, which she sees for herself as a cattle producer as having that sort of teacher always around to show her how she would want to rotate her cows on the pasture. And that when bison are restored, and they're not just a conceptual model, but they're actually in the landscape, they can also respond to changes like climate change. And so it's this dynamic relationship with this relative, with this teacher, rather than just a sort of static relationship with looking at a historical model to inform cattle grazing.
There's two different directions I want to take that. One is I want to stay on this idea of teaching, because I think that is something that is threaded throughout the book. And we're not only learning from the bison on the land, we're learning from the fungi, we're learning from all of these plants, we're listening to them. And so I think that there's, you know, there's certainly fodder for conversation there. But speaking towards these ideas in this chapter, can you talk a little bit more about the ENI initiative? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, the ENI initiative.
Yeah.
So something that I learned when I was researching this book is that I had thought about buffalo restoration as something that individual Native American nations were pursuing. I knew that this was something that was being pursued at Blackfeet. I knew that this was something that was being pursued at Fort Peck. I knew there are various Lakota groups pursuing this. But I learned in researching this book that the entire Blackfoot Confederacy, which includes both people on the U.S. side of the Medicine Line, the U.S.-Canada border, and a bunch of relatives that are on the Canadian side, folks who have had a relationship with one another for a really long time, they were all working together towards this vision of buffalo restoration across a huge landscape. They really had in mind the idea of restoring the traditional territory of buffalo. And so this ENI initiative brought together elders from communities on either side of the Medicine Line, lots and lots of conversations, lots of telling stories, all of the sort of, 2 years of basically surfacing all of this wisdom about this relationship with this animal. And sort of one of the outcomes of that from a policy perspective is this plan for bison to be free roaming in places like Glacier National Park, Waterton National Park in Canada, as well as the current pasture on the Blackfeet Reservation where the Blackfeet Buffalo Program is restoring buffalo. But it's this whole vision of buffalo returning to the landscape in a way that's not just domestic buffalo on individual ranches, but also buffalo as part of the landscape as a wild animal, both of those ways of being in relationship with buffalo.
I really, really love that chapter, not only because we are in Montana, I am from Montana, it resonated with me being familiar with the imagery that you laid down in that chapter and the descriptions, but you were talking, when you were speaking or writing about the grazing, you were talking about grazing animals, specifically bison, that they move, right? They're not just grazing in one place. They're moving from one place to another. And there was another point in the book where you talk about this movement. The voice in that chapter writes something to the effect of loneliness of its vacancy, like of a land's vacancy, right? And this is something that the book sort of makes clear, that leaving the land alone and not working on the land is not necessarily the answer. It's working with the land, with nature. Can you talk about that idea?
I'm really glad you surfaced this, Lauren, because I don't think I would have come up with this on my own, but I think this is a really important piece of how a regenerative agriculture that is informed by indigenous leadership and the leadership of communities of color comes from a very different conceptual place than a regenerative agriculture that's exclusively white-led. And I think it does come back to the way in which the white-led or white-dominated environmental movement is very haunted by this concept of wilderness, which is also then dates back to a concept of human beings as fundamentally damaging of the natural world and fundamentally extractive, and a binary between the human world and the natural world. All of those concepts are linked. And so the white-led or post-colonial environmental movement, the only way that movement oftentimes can imagine restoration or environmental healing is through the exclusion of human presence or human management. And so, of course, that's kind of the history of like the national park system and the wilderness movement. Whereas an indigenous-led regenerative agriculture or a global indigenous-led regenerative agriculture, which brings in, you know, lots of communities of color, thinks a lot about the active role of people in relation to their non-human relatives and the responsibilities that people have to be part of those cycles of life. And so that definitely came out in thinking about relationships between people and buffalo and fire and prairies and how different grasslands are without that human participation in those cycles of life. So it was another example, I think, of thinking of human presence and a particular kind of human presence that has responsibility and relationship attached to it, not as a damaging thing or a bad thing, but actually as necessary, that human participation in those relationships is key to the health of those landscapes.
Liz, what is rematriation?
Yeah. I was new to this term as well and had also heard, you know, repatriation, and it's sort of been institutionalized in legal terms that have to do with giving land back. But rematriation is also about restoring land to indigenous peoples, restoring indigenous territories to those indigenous peoples for whom those are their homelands, but through this matriarchal lens, through this understanding, again, not of land as property, but of land as relation. And so it adds a layer of responsibility that it's not just about transferring the legal title of a piece of land, but it's about supporting the restoration of that full land relationship.
Thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Thank you so much, Lauren. My pleasure.
Look for more information about Liz at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Tom Barrich was our sound engineer for this episode. Our artwork was designed for The Right Question by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.